Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, and I am your host. My work is dedicated to empowering people to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting my website, joyfulvegan.com. And you can also join thousands whose lives have been changed by the 30-Day Vegan Challenge and get yourself on board with the award-winning book or the multimedia online program or both at www.30daveganchallenge.com. Today's topic is vegan in the south of Italy and France. Hi, everybody. I just got back from our vegan trip. And I worked like a maniac to get this podcast written. I just got home on Sunday and it's Tuesday and I really worked to get this written so that we could get it recorded and share this wonderful trip with you and let you know that we're almost done working out the details for the 2016 vegan trip with CPG. And it's definitely Sicily and it's definitely June. So make sure you're on the mailing list at joyfulvegan.com to be the first to hear about it. And I'm very excited about that. A quick shout out to the listeners supporting this podcast. Thank you so much. Without you, I could not focus so much time and energy on this work. So I thank you. And thank you to everyone supporting at every level, as well as to Anne Damsgaard, who is a new gold patron, and to Holly Veer, who recently upgraded to gold, and Susan Gregory, who also upgraded to gold. Thank you, each and every one of you. If you value this podcast, and if you don't know the impact it's having on the world, go listen to the Love Letters episode we just did. And you can listen to 9 other episodes of Love Letters talking about the impact this work has had on people's lives. I'm very grateful for it and I'm honored to do this work. And if you think there's value in it, please consider supporting it by making a one-time contribution or becoming a monthly patron. There are perks and benefits aside from making this work possible, and patrons also get transcripts of each episode, and depending on the monthly level, they also get discounts, including a discount for our trip to Sicily. So details about that are in your Patreon account, so go there and sign in, and you'll hear about that, and go to joyfulvegan.com to support this work. Go under shop, or you'll find the buttons throughout the site, and make a one-time contribution or become a monthly patron. So thank you, everybody, in advance. Also, I wanted to share a super lovely note from Facebook, from a listener on Facebook, or reader, follower, listener on Facebook. It says, going vegan, my biggest sadness was not being able to bake since I love making sweets. I went 1.5 years without baking. It began to wear me down since I had always used baking as a way to release stress. I began to do research and started trying out internet recipes. Unfortunately, most I would find were for healthy baked goods. I'm all for healthy eating, but I think a cookie should be a cookie with real fat and and tooth decaying sugar goodness. Then I found your baking book and I saw the light. I began making the recipes that caught my eye and began experimenting once I had the foundation down. It's been almost 1 year and I've not looked back. Thank you for your books, for your knowledge, and for being a true inspiration for all vegans out there. Thank you for not being perfect. No problem. My pleasure. For embracing what being vegan truly is at heart. Progress, not perfection. Bless you. I love that so much. I just am so grateful for that, because it's exactly why I do this work, is because I know people struggle with certain things and I want to be able to provide remedies for those struggles. That's pretty much it. Like, that's the bottom line. If you want to manifest your values and you're having a struggle with X, Y, or Z, I want to be able to fill in that gap for you. And I'm so grateful to be able to do that. And the baking book was one of those gaps. I wanted people to know that they could still bake, have no deprivation, still enjoy tooth decaying sweetness. I didn't write that in my proposal for the book. This is all about tooth decaying sweetness, but it is really what I wanted. And I do believe that there is a time for a cookie. Many of you have heard me say this. I believe there's a time for broccoli and there's a time for chocolate cake. If you want broccoli, have broccoli. If you want chocolate cake, have chocolate cake. If you want healthy chocolate cake, have broccoli, because the point of sweets is that it's a treat. And that's what the joy of vegan baking is. It's meant to demystify vegan baking and give people the traditional familiar tasting goodies from, you know, from their childhood and from what we all remember. So thank you so much for that note. That was just super lovely. I don't remember the name of the person. I'm not even sure it was a, looks like it's just an internet name, but I will tell you momentarily. It is from, oh my gosh, it's from a wonderful person. I'm having difficulty finding the name of the person. I'm also going through this episode unedited. That is my goal is to do this episode in one take with no edits at all because my engineer is on vacation and I really want to get this out to you ASAP. So I'll wind up editing it myself, but I'm hoping to make no mistakes and just go through this episode, which is going to be a long one because I'm talking all about our trip to Italy. So as many of you know, we have this annual trip to Italy we've been doing, and it's part of these vegan trips with CPG, and we've done a couple now. I've done a short one, now I've done two to Italy, and we already have one planned for next year, and it's really working for me. We personally, my husband and I, tacked on a week in Provence with some good friends of ours, and I'm going to talk about mostly the Provence part. I'm going to talk about Italy a little bit as well, but I did do that episode already for 2015. I did the Vegan in Italy episode. So if you're interested in kind of hearing more about Italy, I mean, frankly, I've done other Italy episodes because I love the country so darn much. It's just, I think, just a magical place. And so I've been to Italy a few times and continue to go back every year, and I'm really grateful for that. But we also went to Provence, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. So this year we went again to southern Italy, particularly to the Cilento region. And really, it's the most northern part of the southern part of Italy. So if you look on a map, Cilento is it's kind of in the northern part of the south, but it's still considered southern Italy, and it's absolutely beautiful. We stay in Cilento National Park, and we visit a ton of little medieval towns all within the park, and each is as charming as the next, I kid you not. We had another great group of people this year, and I'm really so thrilled to see people connect with other like-minded people. One of the things I hear more about than anything is the need for community. The need to have other like-minded vegans in our lives, and yet so many vegans lack this. So organizing these trips, honestly, I feel like a proud mama. Like watching the bonding that takes place so quickly is incredibly gratifying for me. It's why I do these trips. Obviously to get to Italy as well. I'm not going to lie. Of course, I can do those bonding trips here in California, which is also a fabulous place to go. But of course, it enables people to bond with each other, but also travel in a way that is really enjoyable and not worrying about the food and not really thinking about anything and just, you know, relying on my, you know, my affinity for, I don't know, for just having a good time and going to really awesome places. Every time there's so much bonding that takes place, and I see these lifelong friendships form, and it's really incredible. So if you are interested in experiencing this really special experience, make sure you're on the mailing list at Joyful Vegan, as I keep saying. But I'm so grateful. I really do sit back and kind of watch all this, all these friendships take place, and it happens so quickly because these trips are only 7 days, but they're fabulous. And so because I spent a lot of time talking about being vegan in Italy in last year's episode called Vegan in Italy, I don't want to repeat myself. I'll give you a short recap of the highlights of our trip and of the food, and then I'm going to focus mostly on France. Now, I love Italy. I love the history. I love the people. I love the sights. I love the language. And one of the reasons I love doing the trips in Cilento is, and subsequently Sicily, is that we spend a lot of time with locals. And that really means a lot to me because I think that's ultimately where you get the full experience of a place, is really getting to know the people and the language. And it also means that I get to practice my Italian. And of course, I've got a lot of work to do still, but I'm getting better every year. And I spent a lot of time with our driver. His name is Giovanni. And the advantage of practicing with Giovanni is that he also speaks English. So he could explain to me when I got something wrong in Italian. And it was just really enjoyable. And a lot of work. I was exhausted. Like, we would be taking these long drives, and I'd be sitting in the front with him just practicing my Italian, and I'd be absolutely exhausted. But he'd push me and push me. I was really, really happy about it. But oh my gosh, it was so much work. And as much as I was able, I spoke in Italian with him. And it was very funny because as we became more comfortable with each other and we talked about being vegan and trying to talk about it in Italian, even though I could have spoken English to him and he would have understood me, he said what everyone says here in the U.S. and I'm sure other places, that he could be vegan, but, you know, he really doesn't eat a lot of meat. And I told him in Italian that everyone always says that, that everyone says, I don't eat a lot of meat. And my response is, you don't know how much you eat until you stop. Now, I believe him in that in Italy, you do eat a lot less meat than you do in the United States, but still, he said something about liking ham. And I said something about, you know, something in Italian. I said, it's not about the ham. You know, it's not about the pig. It's about the fat, the salt, the texture, the flavor, and the familiarity. And he agreed. So what would that be in Italian? It's about the grasso, sale, which is salt. Grasso is fat. Sale is salt. Consistenza, which is the consistency, the texture. Il gusto, which is the flavor. And the familiarity. And he agreed. And I'm hoping he can help me with some Italian translations of especially the vegan POV videos. By the way, I am opening up the vegan POV videos on YouTube to translators in every language, and there's a really easy way to go about doing it. So if you're interested, certainly contact me, but you can also just go to my YouTube channel and you'll see every video, especially right now, the vegan POV videos, the vegan point of view videos. There's an opportunity to help me translate these videos in every language. So whatever language you speak, if you are interested in doing translation so that there's captions, closed captions, I'd be most grateful. And Giovanni said that he'd be able to hopefully help with the Italian. So we'll see. But I'd rather just get them translated in Italian by someone else so he can actually just read them and hopefully be inspired to try it when he watches the videos. But anyway, I thought it was pretty funny to hear the same thing wherever I go, because that's how people see themselves. Everyone sees themselves as not really eating a lot of animals, but you really don't know how much you eat until you stop. And that's why I wrote the 30-Day Vegan Challenge, which I also want to have translated in every language, but that's a much, much bigger project that would require a lot more resources than I have right now. But that really is my goal, is to be able to get the 30-Day Vegan Challenge translated in every language. So as I said, to be fair, Italians do eat far less meat than North Americans, and it's one of the reasons I love eating in Italy. The majority of the meals during our 7-day trip is taken care of. The majority of the meals is taken care of. And of course, the meals are abundant and delicious and amazing. But eating at restaurants is also incredibly easy. So when you come on these trips with us, most of the meals are just part, you know, it's just part of it. You just show up at a restaurant and all the food is just brought to you. You don't even have to order. You just eat what they bring you. And there are a lot of home-cooked meals also, which is really lovely. But we also eat at restaurants kind of on our own when we have some free time and free days. And eating at restaurants in Italy is incredibly easy. I find that they're all accommodating in terms of just removing the cheese here and taking the meat off there. And of course, everything's cooked in olive oil and not dairy-based butter. So that's really easy. And the meals are also really reasonably priced, even with endless amounts of wine flowing throughout the meal. I'm always shocked when we get the bill. So on our trip, there were 2 days that I didn't participate in what the rest of the group did. One day, I stayed behind in bed because I got sick during our trip. We had a ridiculously stressful journey getting to Italy, and so did my husband. I was with my husband, David, and my friend, Lori, who traveled with us from Oakland to Italy. She's a neighbor of mine, and the stress took its toll, and luckily, it laid me up only for one day, and for the rest of the trip, I just sucked it up, and I wasn't feeling 100% by any stretch, but I was able to just function at least. But the one day I wasn't able to go. And then the second day, Bridie and Seb, who are friends who have joined us on the last Italy trip, they joined us again on this one, and they're joining us again in Sicily. The four of us and a couple other people from the group opted out of going to a town called Padula that we had been to before, and Giovanni took us around to a couple other towns in Cilento, namely Rocinio, which is a town that was abandoned 50 years ago because of a nearby mudslide, and there is where we saw lots of cats and kittens, little baby kittens, little itsy-bitsy kittens, and we also met a horse. And so there's still a couple people kind of in the area, but mostly it's an abandoned town, and it was pretty cool. And then we also went to Aquara, which is a small town in Cilento, and it's where there's a restaurant of a friend of Giovanni, and the restaurant's called La Rosa Bianca. which is named after the owner's daughters whom we met. So the rest of the group had a fabulous day in Padula, and we heard later about their amazing lunch, whose menu was centered around local potatoes. And everyone just raved about this lunch. So next year, perhaps we'll go. But we had our own fabulous day, which included, I kid you not, a four-hour lunch. And that's one of the things that happens in Italy is something, oh my gosh, I mean, I couldn't have four-hour lunches at home, but I've definitely taken back home with me whenever I come back from Italy is just really enjoying meals at a slower pace because we eat so quickly here in the States, at least I'll speak for myself, I do. And I could not do four-hour lunches every day. That's ridiculous. But lunch is a really big meal in Italy, and it's really the biggest meal of all of the meals. And so we had a four-hour lunch, and knowing we were vegan, the owner just made several dishes for us, and each was as fabulous as the next. The best was the first course, which was similar to panzanella. Panzanella is basically a bread salad, and I have a recipe for it in the 30-Day Vegan Challenge. It's a fabulous way to use stale bread, and the rest of the ingredients are tomatoes and olive oil and vinegar and salt and pepper and sometimes basil, and onions are added. And it's also called acqua sale, which is a similar dish meaning water and salt, referring to the stale bread that's often soaked in water and then the water is squeezed out. And then you add the tomatoes and the olive oil and the vinegar and salt and pepper, and just simple and absolutely delicious. And then we had an incredible soup of legumes and lentils, also absolutely delicious. And then a huge platter of grilled seasonal vegetables, including fava beans and escarole and long beans and artichokes. I cannot tell you how much wine we drank, but it flowed for hours, and all of it's locally grown and produced. In fact, there was a vineyard right on the property. I think everyone in Italy has their own vineyard. At least that's what I see, and that's my romantic notion that I hold. But I mean, especially in Cilento, which is also a pretty big agriculture area, it seems like everybody has their own vineyard. So we had a very traditional Italian meal. I mean, the only thing we skipped, of course, was the meat, which is usually part of the second course. So typically there's, first there's an aperitivo, which is usually just like an alcoholic drink, like Prosecco or something like that. And there's olives and crackers. And then there's the antipasto, which is small plates like bruschetta and panini and vegetables. Then there's primo, which is usually pasta and or soup. And then secondo, which is typically where the animal-based meat is. And then contorni or insalate, which is the side dishes or salad. And that also consists of a lot of vegetables. And then there's fresh fruit and often cheese. And then there's a sweeter dessert, with tiramisu or sorbetto or gelato. And we had a lot of that on our trip. So all of that's to say that you can easily eat vegan in any Italian restaurant because most of those courses are vegetable-based or legume-based or plant-based. And of course, there's lots of bread. But there's just so many vegetables and grilled vegetables. So when you go to a restaurant, and I talk about this in the Vegan in Italy episode, look at the contorni, look at the insalate, look at the primo, the soups. And I find it's rare. I mean, of course it happens, but I find it's rare that they use chicken broth for their stock. I often find that it's vegetable stock. And as I said, it's not usually dairy-based butter. It's usually olive oil. So you might even go into a restaurant and just say you're vegan and give a brief explanation of what that means. No eggs, cheese, meat, or butter. And the chef can whip something up for you. I find the menus, it's easy just to read the menu, but that's done in Sicily pretty commonly where you just go and you just kind of trust what the chef is giving you. That's what I loved about the restaurant that Giovanni took us to. And it's what I also love about these organized trips is that you don't even have to order. You don't have to think about anything. Just food comes to you and it's really, really fantastic. So after dinner at this restaurant, we were treated to limoncello, which is not uncommon. And if you've never had limoncello, it's basically a liqueur made from fresh lemons. I find it cloyingly sweet, which says a lot because I have a pretty serious sweet tooth, but I can't not have a little bit when I'm in Italy. And in fact, the first day of the trip, which was in Sorrento on the Amalfi Coast, a number of people from our group learned how to make limoncello in a lemon grove. I'm not kidding. And we didn't go because we were still making our way to the country, having had major delays and flight cancellations and an overall traumatic experience just trying to get to Italy. But those who went had a fabulous time learning to make limoncello in a lemon grove. So At this restaurant, the owners also offered us melancello, which is a liqueur made from melons, and also offered us a liqueur made from pistachio nuts, pistacchio. And we quickly realized after we took a sip that the melancello and the pistachio liqueur, they weren't vegan, like limoncello is vegan. So alas, we lost our veganity at lunch that day. Happens. I have lost my veganity over worst things. This is a new expression, by the way. I don't think I coined this. We were talking about this on the trip. Did I coin it? I'm going to claim it because I can't remember how it came up. But I like this phrase where you lose your veganity, and it's just an expression that I like, and it refers to when you mistakenly eat something or drink something with animal products. You can use it, losing your veganity. So I've lost my veganity. And I've lost my veganity over worse things, like when someone gave me a burrito and it had like pork in it. So losing it over melancello, it's better as far as things go. There was just like casein. It was something like casein when we read the label. But it just goes to show that things like this happen to everyone and you deal with it and you move on. I'm bringing this up, and I didn't have to bring it up. Obviously, I'm choosing to tell you this because even though you do your best, I don't care where you are. If you're at home, if you're at a restaurant, if you're at a friend's house, if you're traveling, you mistakenly eat or drink something. It's just life. It's just what happens. And it, you know, just kind of dealing with it and moving on and remembering what being vegan is about. So we lost our veganity, and now you're all vegan longer than I am. I'm kidding. So yeah, that's what happened. And but limoncello, just so you know, is vegan. It was just this other melancello that we drank. So that's just the way it is. And that lunch was one of our highlights of the trip, in part due to the company, in part due to the fact that it was the day Giovanni realized I could speak some Italian and wanted to help me speak it better. And we just spoke it all day. And I was exhausted at lunch. We were speaking and I was just so wiped out. And then as we were drinking more wine, it got worse. And then of course, in part due to the food, but mostly because it was an unexpected little treasure we didn't plan for. And those are my favorite kinds of experiences. It was really, really, really special. And to boot, the meal was ridiculously inexpensive. I think it was on one hand, because it was Giovanni's friend who owned the restaurant, but I realized later after talking with some locals that it's also because restaurants feel that they're not giving you the whole meal that includes animal-based meat, and therefore they don't feel right charging you for a meal that would typically include meat. So that's an advantage. It's another advantage to being vegan, and it's much nicer than when you're in like the US and you order soy milk at, you know, a coffee place and they charge you more for it. In this case, they charge you less for what you're not getting, what they would normally serve you. So it's pretty fabulous. And photos of this lunch and the location was absolutely unbelievable. We just had this view of the hills and this whole this beautiful valley. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible. So you can see photos and the location and the note and the name of it on the show notes for today's podcast episode at joyfulvegan.com. So the rest of the trip was fantastic. We went to Herculaneum, which is Pompeii's sister city that was also destroyed as well as preserved by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. We had lots of communal dinners together, some of which were prepared by the group. We had what I'm calling the night of 1,000 pizzas. It felt like we had 1,000 pizzas. Gretchen and the folks helping her made, I think it was 10 different pizzas. And that means for a group of 25 or even 30, because it was also including the kids who were there and the helpers. So we had the night of 1,000 pizzas, and everyone was as different as the next, and all completely, you know, no non-dairy cheese, just all filled with vegetables. And there were some stuffed pizzas, which were unbelievable. And we even had a dessert pizza, which included vegan Nutella. And I had asked Gretchen to get some of the vegan Nutella, the one from... My favorite is the one from Endangered Species Chocolate, which is the hazelnut chocolate spread, and it's unbelievable. So she made this really fantastic dough, which is a sweet dough, and then spread the Nutella on it, which was pretty awesome. We had so endless dinners, endless lunches, copious amounts of wine, which, as I discussed in the other episode, you can drink the same amount as you do in the US, although I would never drink as much here as I do when we're on this trip. I'm making it sound like we drink a lot. Well, we do, but you know, it's amazing because the alcohol content is clearly lower, so you just don't have the same experience as when you drink alcohol especially here in California, the wines are much higher in alcohol content and you don't have the hangover. So you can drink the next day as much as you were drinking the day before. So you can opt out of the wine if you don't want to drink it. But it's really lovely because all of the wines that we get are just locally produced. It's locally produced, like right just a few miles down the street, pretty much. So we saw some amazing caves, which was another highlight for me, where there's evidence of early humans and animals who were there living in those caves. We saw ancient Greek temples and amazing sunsets. So it was pretty fabulous. And not unlike our trip from the US to Italy, our flight from Rome to Marseille for us to get to France was also canceled. And luckily we were able to book another flight, but it meant one less day in Provence and one full day in Rome. Now, of course, there are worse things in the world than, oh God, the flight's canceled and now we have to make another flight and we're going to have to spend the day in Rome. So we weren't complaining. We just had to acclimate and kind of figure out what our day would look like. But we really didn't have a lot of energy to do much in Rome. I didn't sleep the night before leaving for Rome. I think David maybe slept an hour. I think Bridie and Seb at least slept a few more hours than that. But it was a combination of the last night was very late, everyone saying goodbye to each other. And then I was still dealing with the stupid cold. And then we had to get up at 4 a.m. to get our transfer to Naples to get the train to Rome. And so it was very early. And so when the four of us arrived in Rome, it was all we could do to just rent a hotel room for the day. And if you've never done that, I recommend it. If you have some, you know, if you're traveling and you need to just kind of sleep for a little bit and your hotel isn't ready or you're just there for the day or whatever, we just got a day room and it was pretty awesome because we slept for several hours and then we felt rejuvenated enough to take on Rome for just a few hours. So we went to dinner and then we were kind of crunched for time at that point. We hailed a taxi from the restaurant back to our hotel, not before stopping at this amazing place, and we had the taxi driver wait for us because then we needed him to take us to the little airport to bring us to Marseille. But we stopped at a place called Olive Dolci, which is a vegan gelateria, a vegan gelato place, 100% vegan, 30 flavors. The menu has 30 different flavors, all vegan, and the place itself is absolutely adorable. And the gelato was delicious. There was also maybe some sorbetto there as well. But I think it was mostly gelato. I don't know. I kind of went like I made a beeline for the chocolate gelato. And all of the gelato is made from olive oil, which makes it really rich and really smooth and really creamy. And the flavors, just name a flavor. I mean, they were just absolutely amazing. There was pistachio and chocolate mint and peanut and coffee and strawberry and lots of other fruits. And it was just fabulous. So again, go to joyfulvegan.com, the page for this show, and you will find a link to the gelateria, which was amazing. So now I want to just move on to France because that's where we spent the rest of the next week. And I haven't talked about France and I'm going to talk about it in just a moment, but I first want to thank today's compassionate podcast partner, the American Anti-Vivisection Society at aavs.org. AAVS is dedicated to ending the use of animals in science through education, advocacy, and the development of alternative methods. And because this is always welcome, we have great news to share, really great news to share. On June 12th, 2015, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, FWS, announced that it will classify all chimpanzees as endangered. Now, it's not good news that chimpanzees are endangered, but previously, the Fish and Wildlife Service categorized captive chimps as only threatened and wild chimps as endangered. And this distinction allowed for their use in research and entertainment. So now with all chimpanzees being classified as endangered, it means that starting in September, anyone owning chimpanzees must have a permit from FWS, which is really significant. It really alters the what they can do with chimpanzees. And this is really on the road toward abolishing the use of chimpanzees in research and entertainment. So thanks to AAVS for doing this. And also just to give you an update on what I talked about two episodes ago regarding the Liberia chimps, who were abandoned by the New York Blood Center. They were abandoned in Liberia. So far, over $110,000 of emergency funds have been raised to help these chimps, and over 170,000 people have signed the petition asking the New York Blood Center to reinstate funding to care for these chimpanzees. You can add your support and your voice by going to aavs.org/Liberia. Just to give you a little background again, if you don't remember, the New York Blood Center set up a lab in Liberia in the 1970s. The chimpanzees have been retired for at least a decade, and in the past, the New York Blood Center acknowledged its responsibility to financially support these animals, including in retirement. However, as of March 6th, 2015, it completely stopped all funding. So despite the fact that the New York Blood Center has $450 million in assets every year, it refuses to support these chimps. So the $107,000 that AAVS and other organizations have raised to help these chimps is just, you know, is not enough, and it's not sustainable to take care of these chimps. The New York Blood Center needs to be held accountable, but at least right now, because they're dependent upon us humans for their care, the AAVS and other organizations are raising money to help them. So, but we still need your help. We need your help, A, raising the, continuing to raise funds so that we can take care of these animals, and B, signing this petition to make the New York Blood Center accountable and accept its responsibility to care for these animals. So please go to aavs.org/Liberia and take action today. And thank you, AAVS, for the support of this podcast to help me spread the word to all of you. So after 7 days in the Cilento region of Italy, well, six for those of us who lost a day because of a canceled flight, not bitter or anything, we began our journey to France. And the last time I was in France was about 18 years ago when I went to Paris. I was only in Paris. And at the time I was working as an editor for a travel publication. And I traveled a bunch at the time, staying in some pretty amazing places that were fully comped, which was really fabulous. So I, you know, my background being in writing and editing and my desire to travel, it was really a perfect combination, but it's not what I wanted to do. And plus that was back in New Jersey before we were moving to California. And so I was dating David at the time, but I took a girlfriend with me to this European trip, on this European trip. And he's never let me forget it. He's just so bitter about it. He just will not stop talking about it. And we were already planning to move to California, David and I. So I don't know why I didn't take him. I think it's just because, I don't know, I knew we were going to spend the rest of our lives together. Or so I predicted. And so I took a friend with me. So David, get over it. Just get over it, okay? I've made up for it. So just get over it. So when I was there with my girlfriend, we visited, and to make it worse, David drove us to the airport, really rubbed it in there. So we visited Paris and Bruges in Belgium and Amsterdam. Now, I wasn't vegan at the time, but I was vegetarian. And I remember only that I ate a lot of cheese, a lot of brie, a lot of Nutella crepes, and a lot of Gouda. So that was the last time I was in France. And this time, David and I were going together. He had been there when he had finished college. He'd been to also just Paris. He had never been to Provence. So it was really lovely to be able to go together, along with our friends Bridie and Seb, who you heard a ton about in the Vegan in Italy trip from 2014. And many of you know Bridie because she answers my email. So we decided to spend the bulk of our time in Provence. And I hadn't been to Provence, David hadn't been to Provence, Seb hadn't been to Provence, but Bridie had led tour groups there many, many years ago. So it was her chance to share a place that was really special to her with all of us. So we rented an Airbnb, and for those who aren't aware, Airbnb is just a way to increase accommodations options for people. So Airbnb enables you to rent your home through this service, Airbnb. And you can also just rent, I mean, there are other ways to rent people's homes when you're traveling, but Airbnb has become very, very popular and we love it. And we use Airbnb when we travel for the most part. We used to go to bed and breakfast, but we love, especially when we're, I don't know, we just love being able to have our own kitchen and be able to cook and get our own food, etc. So we knew we wanted to have that experience in Provence. We wanted to be in the countryside and we wanted to be in a house rather than in a hotel. And it's definitely something I recommend to anyone who's traveling. Wherever you're traveling, we do it domestically and we also do it when we travel internationally. From a vegan perspective, it's not that you can't find edible food if you stay at a hotel, but frankly, I can eat out only so much when I travel. Last night was the first night that I cooked a meal since we've been back. We've only been back, like I said, a day, basically. But I was so happy to be back in my kitchen. I mean, we cooked when we were at the Airbnb a lot, actually. But just being in my kitchen, I just love eating home-cooked meals. And, you know, you can eat out every day if you want, every meal if you want, but I find it that it gets old. And so we were in Italy. We had a ton of home cooked meals, like I said, because the group, we stayed at the villa and Gretchen arranged for home cooked, you know, they basically cook for us. And then also in France, we just didn't want to eat out that much. So we wanted to have the Airbnb. But even if you can, I'm just suggesting this, you don't have to do this just because you're vegan. Like, it's not the only option. You can definitely eat out. But the truth is, and I'll be really honest with you, eating out in restaurants in Provence is not nearly as exciting and vegan friendly as eating out in Italy. It's getting better, and I'm going to tell you about a couple experiences we had. But honestly, your best bet is to rent an Airbnb and enjoy the many markets selling fresh produce, especially when you're in the countryside, especially when you're in Provence, and especially when you're in anywhere in the summer. I mean, because you can also do this in the city. There's lots of markets in the cities as well. But in the summer is really when you're going to find all this amazing produce. Now, I am spoiled living in California, whose weather and agriculture are conducive to year-round farmers markets, but elsewhere around the world, summer is really the best time for produce markets. So I really recommend summer. Summer, if you can take the heat, I mean, go on the early side of summer. I melted when I was there, and I think it was unseasonably hot, but I could not wait to get back to California. I'm so soft. I'm just ridiculous. Like, where we are for me is perfect weather, and weather plays a huge part in me just knowing where I want to live. And I could not live in, like, I couldn't live in, you know, Italy or France during the summer. I would die. It was so, so humid. And, it's not my cup of tea. Actually, it was funny because we were in Italy. It was fine. The weather was actually perfect. But once we got to Provence, it was just ridiculously hot and humid. And Paris was an oven. Anyway, but other than that, it was fabulous. So we rented this little house in Saint-Rémy and we enjoyed many beautiful breakfasts and lots of long, late dinners. And for lunch, we would sometimes pack our lunch, sometimes we would eat out, sometimes we ate in, and sometimes we just snacked on market food, which was plenty sufficient until we returned back home to eat a larger meal. So we were often gone the entire day, so our dinners were typically eaten pretty late, but they're really a highlight. It's another highlight of the trip for me, just these long, again, these long dinners, spending that kind of quality time with my husband and good friends, talking and eating and drinking and laughing, playing stupid games. We played quite a few stupid games. These are memories that will last a lifetime for sure, and definitely a highlight for me. Before I forget, all of the videos I created while we were traveling in both Italy and France are on my YouTube channel, and you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. You can search for Joyful Vegan at YouTube, but these videos relevant to the trip are also on the page for this episode of joyfulvegan.com, and you can see the kinds of things we were eating for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, including when we went out. And we had a lovely experience at a restaurant in a small town called Chateau Neuf du Pape. And I really encourage you to go over to joyfulvegan.com or YouTube and go look at the video. It was just a really lovely experience at a Provençal restaurant who was more than happy to accommodate us. So take a look at those videos and I think it will help you get a sense of how we ate. And we ate well. We ate a little too well. I really think I gained 5 pounds. And because I was battling this cold, I didn't hike and walk as much as I normally would have. So we really ate so much. So any idea that you're going to starve when you go away, it's just a fear that's unfounded. I just want to really impress that upon you. Speaking of eating, before we left, David was doing some reading about the areas we were visiting, including he was reading a book called A Guide to Provence by Michael Jacobs, which he really enjoyed, and I've skimmed since. So David called attention to a couple passages in the chapter called The Food and Drink of Provence, and I want to read a little bit for you. So there's a lot to say, and I'm not going to read all this to you, but what I really want to impress upon you is that we have this notion that French cuisine is very animal-based and not plant-based at all. And That's true, especially in a lot of touristy areas. But really, one of the things that I keep coming back to in my work is the foundation of this cuisine, like the foundation of pretty much every cuisine, is plants. And it's really hard to pinpoint a Provençal cuisine because it's been influenced by so many other cuisines and countries, including Italy. And I mean, the Romans were there for a long time, which is also to say that, by the way, I didn't mention before, is that when you're eating at restaurants in the south of France, there are plenty of Italian restaurants. You don't have to just go to French restaurants. There are plenty of Italian restaurants, which I would argue is as traditional as going to Provençal restaurants, even more traditional if you go farther back, because the Romans were there. And of course, they really affected the cuisine. But the olive is really very much a Provençal food. So olive oil, olives themselves, it's really prevalent in the cuisine. There's lots to say about that. So that's easy. Garlic is another food that is prevalent in French cuisine, especially Provençal. Let's see, what else? Of course, herbs, you know, and I mentioned the markets already, so you're already going to find all of that. But there is something to be said for what happened in terms of replacing vegetables with what really become a meat-heavy diet. And that is, most of these dishes, the sort you find in restaurants and cookery books, bear little relation to the everyday food of the Provençal people. Until comparatively recently, meat and even fish was never eaten more than once a week, and often only on feast days and special occasions. At the beginning of this century, the two butcher's shops in the Vaucluse town of Lille-sur-la-Sorgue were open only around Christmas and Easter. The main sustenance of both the country folk and the urban dweller was provided by soup and vegetables. Vegetables were nearly always boiled and served with vinaigrette, and the water in which they had been cooked served as the basis of the soup. And there's a lot more to say about that. So it was, you know, often when, especially when Provence in this region became very touristy, is really when you see the increase in the consumption of meat. So that's just one thing to say. Of course, there's tapenade, which is made from oil, which is made from olives. But I do think the tapenade is often made with anchovies. So you do want to ask about that. When I think of tapenade, of course, I use capers and I use olives and olive oil and garlic and herbs. But in Provence, I think they do use anchovies. So you'll want to ask about that. Soca is a common hors d'oeuvre in Provence. And soca is, I have a recipe in the 30-day vegan challenge, I kid you not. It's basically a chickpea flour, and you fry it and cut it into slices, and you can put lots of wonderful things on top of it. But it's basically like a chickpea pancake. Another common Provençal dish is pistou. Well, not dish, but a food is pistou, which is like a pesto, but it's it doesn't have the nuts. So a pistou is oil, olive oil, garlic, and basil. And it is often used for like a vegetable soup on top, or a bean soup on top of the soup. It's not used like pesto would be in Italian cuisine, but it's very traditional. You know, salad greens, just a lot of wild greens like dandelions is very common. Endive is very common. Chickpeas, pois chiche, which is my favorite word in French, is very common, and you'll find that very easily when you're shopping. Mushrooms are very Provençal, especially the black mushroom. The truffle is very common. And ratatouille is of Nice origin. So that's in Provence. And ratatouille, I have a ratatouille also, I think, in, oh my gosh, now I'm blanking. It might be Vegan Table, might be Vegan's Daily Companion. And ratatouille is basically just vegetables, right? It's a vegetable dish, like a stew. So that's very Provençal. And of course, you've got the wine, and you've also got pastis, which is a liqueur made from like aniseed. So it's got that really licorice-y flavor. So the point I am making is that, you know, we tend to say traditional, not traditional. And, you know, plant foods are as traditional as the bouillabaisse and the aioli and the goat's cheese are in Provence. It's just not necessarily going to be reflected in restaurant menus. But I just want to impress that upon you that it's very traditional to eat lots of vegetables in Provence and, of course, in the cities. And you see this reflected in the markets. There's an abundance. I can't even name everything. Just, I mean, think about plant foods and they're in the markets. I mean, when we also would just get olives and garlic, cloves and bread and sun-dried tomatoes and raspberries and strawberries and beans and a ton of things we couldn't get because we were leaving and we couldn't, you know, we couldn't cook everything, but it was really fantastic. And then eating out, you know, apps like Happy Cow and Yelp made it so much easier to find good food. Now, a note about bread. There is nothing like going to a boulangerie in the morning and buying fresh baguettes. Nothing like it at all. And of course, we made a habit of that. I honestly just want to make bread every day. I love making bread, but I haven't done it in a long time. And I need to just return to that because it's just so fabulous. And the French take their bread very seriously. Of course, lack of bread was the principal complaint from the people of Paris during the French Revolution. And it played a huge part in trying to overthrow the monarchy. So there are bread laws, like they're called bread laws. And these bread laws mandate how bread is labeled depending on how it's made and where it's made. A boulangerie can only be called such if the bread is made on the premises. So if you go into a bread place and it's not called boulangerie, the bread is not made on the premises. Depending on what starters are used, it really plays a huge role. Now, unless cheese is added to the bread, you know, like at the end, like on the top of the bread, and that's very obvious. It'll be in the name, but you can also see it. The bread itself is always vegan. The law states that traditional baguettes have to be made on the premises where they're sold, and can only be made with four ingredients: wheat flour, water, salt, and yeast. That's the law. Okay, so don't worry about, you know, the bread not being vegan when you're in France. Again, like I said, if there's just cheese sprinkled on the crust, you know, at the very end, that's very different. That's a very special thing, whatever. It's a, you know, it's a particular kind of bread because they're flavoring it. Sometimes they're seeded baguettes, etc. But the bread itself is vegan. So you'll be able to distinguish between the you know, the one that has cheese and just not order that one. But that's like so not even the most common one. And of course, the bread isn't meant to last more than a day. I mean, it's really meant to to be kind of eaten that day. And you might remember from my note in the vegan table, day-old bread can be salvaged by using it to make pain perdu, which translates to lost bread or French toast. That's our French toast, is because they were using everything. Because, you know, I have to say, in Europe, especially traditionally, they don't waste things the way we do. And I don't mean to keep comparing like that. I think there was a time we didn't waste things as much either, talking 50 years ago. And I think it's something we can return to. And I hate wasting food so much. So I love the idea of using up everything you can, especially when you have stale bread, and using it to make something like panzanella or French toast. Now, when we were in Arles, speaking of restaurants and apps that helped us, Arles, of course, is where Vincent van Gogh painted and has a huge presence there. We sat at the Van Gogh Cafe just to have a refreshment, and Seb twisted my arm to order French fries, which we did, or fries, or pommes frites. He also discovered a little sandwich takeout place that had plenty of options for sandwiches. They also had sushi and tofu, and we didn't get sushi, but I was like, yay, tofu, because I love tofu. So there's a little Asian bent there as well. But this sandwich was a takeaway place made to order, and I didn't love the attitude of the staff. Didn't love the attitude. It was the only time in the whole time we were in France, and I'm going to say it loud and say it proud, it was the only time I found an attitude in any service people while we were there. I want to just completely debunk any myth that the French are rude. I mean, it's a stereotype. Like, you know, stereotypes exist for a reason. I get that. But if I hadn't heard about that, I would have been like, what are you talking about? Every single person we met was so kind and so generous and so giving and helpful. There were times we would go to a restaurant and there wasn't a table outside. We wanted to sit outside. They brought a table outside from inside, set up the place setting, set up the chairs, and had us sit there. I mean, that's just one example of many. So to say that there was one person with an attitude, that's not a reflection of France. I'm not even saying it for that reason. It's just a reflection of this guy who chastised me when I took a photo of their menu to share with you. And he said, you know, he said, are you going to post that online? You know, what are you going to do with the photo? And I said, he's like, are you going to post it online? And I was like, yeah, I was going to share it. And he's like, don't, you can't do that. And I was like, okay, fine. I won't promote your restaurant. So I will give you the name of the restaurant because I want you to have it. It's on the joyfulvegan.com page for this episode. But I don't have a picture of it because apparently I'm not supposed to take a picture. I think I can take a picture. I took a picture of the sign of the restaurant. I'm being snarky about it because he really had an attitude, but he didn't want me to take a picture of the menu. So fine, whatever. But it was really great. We ordered a bunch of sandwiches and put them in some bags, and we headed out to find horses in the Camargue. So the Camargue is a very interesting place. I first heard about the Camargue, or saw the Camargue, and thought it was a magical land because of a film that I saw a few years ago, and which is on my list of animal conscious films, which is also at joyfulvegan.com. And it's a film called White Mane. And White Mane is a short 47 minute long 1953 film by Albert Lamoureux, who is a director who also directed the very well-known short film called The Red Balloon. I remember seeing that film in like film class in high school. So it might be familiar to you. It's a very sweet film. Both of these films are incredibly beautifully shot, beautiful films. And White Mane is less well-known than Red Balloon, I think, but it's also critically acclaimed. In fact, it won the Short Film Palme d'Or Award at the Cannes Film Festival back in the 50s. It's a beautiful fable of how a young boy befriending and protecting a wild stallion called White Mane. And after being captured several times by ranchers, White Mane finally gains the trust of Falco, who's the little boy, who protects him by riding him out to sea. And as the narrator states, to an island where horses and children can be friends forever. It's a really beautiful film with the most beautiful 13-year-old boy you will ever see on film. It's kind of ridiculous, very quintessentially French, this gorgeous, gorgeous little boy. And the film itself is beautiful. So we watched it again when we were in Saint-Rémy. We had seen it, David and I saw it a few years ago. And I was just so curious about this place because it takes place in the Camargue and it's filmed in the Camargue. And it just seemed like there were wild horses there because that was part of the story. And we started looking into it and was like, yeah, there's wild horses in the Camargue. So I wanted to go there because it just looked like this magical land. It turns out the history is a bit more complicated than simply there are wild horses in the Camargue. And so it was a little disappointing, but we knew also that there were flamingos there and lots of birds and bulls. And so I went on a quest for more information. So the story, White Mane, is indeed based on real horses who are in the Camargue. And the story goes that for centuries, and the Camargue is in this region of southeast France, for centuries, possibly thousands of years, these small horses, these smaller horses have lived in the wild in this harsh environment of the wetlands of the Rhone Delta. And that's where the Camargue is. It's right in the Rhone Delta. And there's evidence to suggest, there's definitely evidence that to suggest that they were definitely there in the time of the ancient Greeks. So these horses have been there a long time. And the horses themselves are really beautiful. They're all white until they're about 4 years old, because prior to that, the foals are all brown, like a darker brown. But they're all white when they're adults. I love that. That's even more romantic. So the Camargue itself is it's a very marshy area between the Mediterranean Sea and the two arms of the Rhone River Delta. And so the image of these gorgeous horses, these white horses running along the beach, is incredibly romantic. And I wanted to witness it myself, but alas, it was not to be. We discovered that the horses are not so wild after all. They're semi-wild, as of course things have changed since the Greeks a little bit. And so the Camargue itself is about 350 square miles large, and about one third of the Camargue is either lakes or marshland. And so it's home to about, like I said, 400 species of birds. There's egrets, there's flamingos who migrate from Africa. And we saw a ton of egrets and flamingos, which was pretty amazing. I even took home a little pink feather. But as for the horses and the cattle, the bulls, they're semi-wild and they can roam freely in the park, which is now protected. So they absolutely are wild in that sense. They're not penned at all, but they're also used for parades and events. They're also rounded up for culling, and I knew that was the case. Of course, it's never said, you know, in any of the signs in the park, but I knew that they weren't going to be able to let these animals just keep breeding on their own. So they're rounded up and culled, which is a nice way of saying killed, and they're also rounded up for medical treatment, which is, I have no problem with that. But the Camargue horse is considered one of the oldest breeds of horse. And in the late 18th century, a group of people moved into the area, and they still exist somewhat today, but mostly as a tourist attraction. And they're called the Gardians, which is basically they're ranchers who make their living by herding the bulls on horseback. So the bulls, the Camargue bulls, have also been in the Camargue since the time of the Greeks. They were definitely there during Roman times, and they're native to this area. In fact, and I do find this a little fascinating, the cattle depicted in the prehistoric cave paintings in Lascaux, which I've talked about in France, resemble these Camargue cattle. Sadly, the bulls are used for bullfighting, so this is where they breed them, and they're used for the bullfights. And the animals not suitable for the bull ring or for breeding are sold for beef. And in fact, the store there, when we went to one of the little kiosks, had sausage, whatever they had. I don't know. It didn't look very hard, but it was some dried flesh. So the bulls are raised for the bullfights, are used for an indigenous genre of bullfighting, widely common in the Provence and Languedoc areas. And it's known alternatively as the course libre, which is, you know, the free course. Basically, I'll read to you what it says on Wikipedia, just so you have an idea of what this is distinguished from, like, Spanish bullfighting. It's still despicable in my opinion, but here it is. This is a bloodless spectacle. Bloodless for the bulls, in which the objective is to snatch a rosette from the head of a young bull. The participants, or rossiteurs, begin training in their early teens against young bulls from the Camargue region of Provence before graduating to regular contests held principally in Arles and Nîmes, but also in other Provençal and Languedoc towns and villages. Before the course, an abrivado, a running of the bulls in the streets, takes place, so the same thing that happens in Spain, in which young men compete to outrun the charging bulls. Stupid. But the course, it's so ridiculous. Anyway, the course itself, I'll stop editorializing. The course itself takes place in a small, often portable arena erected in a town square for a period of about 15 to 20 minutes. The rossiteurs compete to snatch rosettes tied between the bull's horns. They do not take the rosette with a bare hand, but with a claw-shaped metal instrument called a rosset or crochet hook in their hands, hence the name. Afterwards, the bulls are herded back to their pen by guardians, the Camargue cowboys, in a bandido amidst a great deal of ceremony. The stars of these spectacles are the bulls, who get top billing and stand to gain fame and status in their honor and lucrative product endorsement contracts. That's hilarious to me that it actually says that. Someone should go and alter that in Wikipedia, because it's ridiculous that the bulls actually get lucrative endorsement contracts. Obviously, it's the people who do. And then, of course, they're killed, no doubt, and eaten. So, you know, I wanted to share that just because I wanted to give the full story of it. It's not to say that we shouldn't have gone to the Camargue. We didn't go to the bullfight. We just went to this, you know, this beautiful and rugged park in southeast France, and it was really worth it because we did see a couple horses. We didn't really see any. We saw a couple towards the end who were actually with some bulls. It was kind of behind someone's property, and it was kind of striking to see these white horses next to these dark, dark bulls. So, but we didn't really see the horses. We were hoping to see them running wild on the beach, and we didn't seek out the bulls because I just felt bad for them. But my romantic notions of this wild space, of course, were dashed, but we still enjoyed our time there. And I will always remember driving through the marshes, spotting pink flamingos at sunrise as we sang songs from Flight of the Conchords. So that was pretty awesome. And we had lots of other wonderful highlights from the trip. Highlights for me is the day we spent going from medieval town to medieval town in the Luberon, which is definitely something I would recommend if you go to southern France. We went to Orange, and Orange was definitely a highlight for me because we visited an ancient Roman theater, which was incredibly impressive just in terms of scale and history. But we also stumbled upon Jonas Kaufmann, who is a very famous tenor, rehearsing for Carmen, the opera they were putting on while they were there. So that was pretty awesome, is that we saw this world-renowned tenor. David and I love opera, and so we knew who Jonas Kaufmann was, and we just happened to stumble upon him rehearsing for Carmen. So I want to go back there someday to Orange and see a concert in an ancient Roman theater. Another highlight was buying food at a market and picnicking under a tree in one of those small towns in the Luberon, driving around, seeing endless lavender and sunflower fields. That was really beautiful. Visiting the ancient Roman ruins at Glanum, just outside of Saint-Rémy. So I recommend that if you like Roman ruins, as I do. Going to a quintessential Provençal market in Saint-Rémy is where we went, but there's also traditional, you know, Provençal markets throughout Provence in the summer. And then we happened upon a black and white tuxedo cat, which was awesome. And getting ready for Paris. So that was another highlight. And we were only in Paris for exactly a day and a half. We made the most of it, unlike with Rome, where we were exhausted and we had to sleep. At least in Paris, we were able to spend the whole day and somewhat of the next day in Paris. And you will be able to see my video of my day in Paris on YouTube and also at joyfulvegan.com. But in short, we shopped at Le Monde Vegan, which is an all-vegan store in France, the only all-vegan store in France. And of course, it's in Paris. And we bought some Vegusto cheese, which I know if you're in Europe, you know of Vegusto cheese. It is fabulous. And piquant is the flavor that's my favorite. We brought some home with us, but it was really, really fabulous. We had lunch at the Gentle Gourmet, which is a fantastic all-vegan cafe run by an American. And it was fun because we were also joined by our friends, Michael and Alex, who live in Oakland, and they're good friends of ours. They were in France at the same time, so it was fun to have lunch with them. We had dinner at Potager du Marais, enjoying the most delicious French onion soup and just a fabulous menu. It's a traditional French menu, all vegan. Walking along the Seine was lovely. Going to a couple squares, visiting Notre Dame. We had been there. David and I had each been there separately years before, and sweating our beeps off. It was just a little too hot for me. I won't be visiting in the summer anytime soon. But I'm back here in California, and the weather is perfect. Kind of perfect. Kind of have to say that. Just gonna say it. Just love living in California. I'm a very picky pansy when it comes to weather. I'm soft. I admit it. I grew up in New Jersey. I know of humid weather. I know what it's like. I know what it feels like, and I don't like it. And moving to California, Northern California, it just made me soft. And I'm so soft that I don't even like going into San Francisco makes me freeze. So Oakland is kind of my little perfect place. Although it's been a little cloudy, I might have to go south for the summer, as they say, because it actually gets chilly here in the summertime. August is our coldest month here, even in Oakland, where I find the most perfect weather. But alas, happy to be home. Really, really thrilled to be home. I think I mentioned that David got sick in Provence, but he's finally getting better, and I'm all better. And it was nice to have a very uneventful trip back from Paris to San Francisco, a nonstop flight. And I'm just really, really, really grateful for having that opportunity and being able to share it with all of you. So whether you go to Europe with us next year or again in a future year, or you go on your own, I really hope these episodes are helpful for you. I do not do this for my own gratification. I'm thrilled to share our experiences, but I'm doing it for you so it would help you have a much more enjoyable trip when you are traveling to such places. And I hope to continue sharing our travels with you as we have more. And so that concludes my journey to the south of Italy and the south of France. And next year, as I said, we're going even further south as we take a group of 20 people to Sicily. And I hope you're one of them. We will enjoy the history, the beauty, the nature, including Mount Etna, the people, the language, and the food of this amazing place. And I've never been to Sicily. I am super excited. And I know my Italian's not even going to help me that much because the dialects are totally different in Sicily. But I hope you can join us. Make sure you're on the mailing list at joyfulvegan.com if you're interested in hearing about this trip and everything else I'm doing to empower people to make informed food choices and live in alignment with their values of compassion and kindness. Thank you to all of the listeners who are supporting this podcast. Please, if you are a monthly supporter, please make sure your credit card information is updated over at Patreon. I'm not getting really the amount of money that people are pledging because of credit card declines, and it's always such a problem with monthly contributors. So if you could just check and make sure that your pledge is going through. It also costs me money to actually reach out to you and ask you to check your credit card. So if you are a monthly supporter, can you please make sure that you really are? Because what you see reflected on the Patreon page is in terms of how much is being pledged does not reflect how much I actually get. So sorry to be a Debbie Downer there, but I know if you want to support this work, I know you're going to want to make sure that it actually gets to me. And right now, a lot of it isn't getting to me. So thank you so much for supporting. And if you are confident in the impact this work is having, I urge you to also go to joyfulvegan.com, click on the Patreon button, or become a one-time donor. And thank you to AAVS, the American Anti-Vivisection Society, at aavs.org. Get thee over to aavs.org. Get involved. Help the animals for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.